Good evening, everyone. I'm Paul Jaber. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm very happy to welcome you to this locale. We don't meet here very often. It's very nice. And we have a very interesting program for you tonight with a delegation from the American Security Project. Unlike normal modus operandi, this time I'm going to ask our friend and fellow board member Stacy Stanley to moderate the session in my stead. And the reason why is that Stacy, unbeknownst to me, and I don't know how many other members here and fellow members of the council, has an outstanding aspect of his many activities which deals very directly with the subject of tonight's program. And therefore, he will do a terrific job of moderating the discussion tonight. Stacy ran the Global Climate Monitoring Program for the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Switzerland. And they are the ones who published the first comprehensive metric analysis of climate indicators. This publication is now annual, and it is something that reports, a publication reports on the state of the planet based upon changes in biodiversity, ecosystems, and humanity's demand on natural resources. He has also worked with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the leading international body for the assessment of climate change, established by the United Nations Environment Program. The chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, is someone that Stacy has worked with in India on monitoring India's metrics on the subject. So I'm very pleased to turn over the session to Stacy, and he will take it from here.
Thank you, Paul. If you'll indulge me in a couple of brief housekeeping announcements, the first is I would like Kathy Sheehy back here, who represents AFS, to come up and give us her two-minute pitch on the foreign student program that we feel is very important, and it's a part of the World Affairs Council as well. So, Kathy.
Thank you. Again, my name is Kathy Sheehy. I'm here representing AFS, formerly known as American Field Service. And what we do is we have a local chapter here that I'm a volunteer of, and we're always looking for host families to host exchange students from give or take about 90 countries coming to the United States, and also students that live here that would like to study abroad. We have summer programs, we have semester and year-long programs as well. So I'm just excited to be here and excited to partner with World Council and to be able to just make the world a little bit smaller, break down those stereotypes of different cultures, and just share our local community with these students and open up our homes to these students that are coming to study here. So I will be available after the event if anybody has any questions or want any literature. I have brought some to give out as well. So thank you.
And I want to make a pitch for one of our nonprofit members, the Global Charity Foundation, which sponsors the 100 Black Men's Tutoring Program here in Las Vegas, as well as the Children's Free Clinic for the school system. They're holding a fundraiser out at Siena on the 20th of June, and if anybody is interested in joining them for the evening, I do have tickets available, and I'd be glad to sell those to you later on. And now we're going to move forward with the program of the evening. And I want to recognize that we're very, very fortunate and honored to have Ms. Pat Moroy here with us this evening. And for those of you who do not know who Pat is, she is the recently retired head of the Southern Nevada Water District. And she is generally considered, and I think rightfully so, the most knowledgeable person in water management in the Colorado River Basin, which includes the seven states and Mexico that make up the basin. And as we all know, that is our source of water. And the reason we are enjoying this evening is through Pat's good work over many, many years. She is now a fellow with Brookings Institute, and thank you very much for joining us this evening. Now, any discussion when you talk about defense and climate change, we all look around and say, why is that important to us? We're fairly well insulated from those kinds of threats, we believe, here in Nevada. But if you notice, last week there were two articles in the paper. One pointed out that carbon dioxide levels hit the highest level in history at 400 parts per million, according to the World Meteorological Organization. That becomes the tipping point for temperature rise. The second thing is that in an article last week, it listed the cities in the United States that have had the highest increase in average temperature since 1996. Carson City is number one, and Las Vegas is number five. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, and we're not going to get into those, but these are just a couple of quick metrics so that we understand where we're coming from today in speaking about the impact of climate change as it relates to the defense of our country. The Department of Defense has stated that climate change poses a threat, destabilizing weak and failed states. So that means it's not just whether it's going to raise water levels in Norfolk, Virginia, or cause other types of climatic impacts. It is that it can destabilize regimes and the demand for water and agricultural area and things that cause real threats to us that require intervention. May 17, 2014, there was a report issued by the IPCC that talked about what is going to be the impact of climate change over the next 50 years. A U.S. military task force concluded that the IPCC's projections actually underestimated the potential sea level rise. So that's our military saying that the climate change people are being too conservative. In 2010, the Department of Defense issued its Quadrennial Defense Review, which is a major strategic planning document, and they said that climate change, energy security, and economic stability are inextricably linked. Climate change poses a significant threat to each of our different defense forces, which I'm sure we're going to hear more about tonight. If you listen to NPR this week, there's an article about the sea rising in Norfolk, Virginia, and the threat that poses to the largest harbor that the U.S. Navy has in the world. Admiral Samuel Locker III, the head of the U.S. Pacific Command, identified climate change and its related impacts as the biggest threat facing U.S. forces in the Pacific, telling the Boston Globe in an interview in March that warming is probably the most likely thing that is going to happen and it will cripple the security environment. So with that overwhelming bit of background on the way the military proceeds in the literature, tonight we are fortunate in having three presentations by flag generals and a science member of the APC, which is, as we pointed out, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy and research organization in Washington, D.C., founded back in 2007. And they are talking specifically about the strategic responses to the climate change threats of the 21st century. We have Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, who is U.S. Marine Corps retired. He is the CEO of APC and is joined by Lieutenant General Norman C., who is retired Air Force and has taken a very strong position on climate change as well as many other initiatives. So what I'd like to do is turn the program over to them for the evening, and then we'll engage in a Q&A as they warmly agreed to participate in, and they don't have much of a agenda, so as long as we want to talk about it, I believe they're going to let us engage in it. So with that, I'd like to ask General Cheney to come up and take over the evening. Thank you.
Stacy, did you read my speech? He's covered about six of the points that I was going to cover, so I won't cover those all over again. Let me make a couple of introductory comments here for a second. First off, what a lovely venue, and Stacy and Paul, this is a great place. We spent the morning at a sewage treatment plant in San Antonio. This is a breath of fresh air. And we've been on a road show now for about 6 weeks discussing this particular topic, which is very important to us, and I'm very pleased to have you all here and know that you have an interest in it. Let me talk a little bit about the American Security Project, how we were founded, how I ended up there, why do we care about climate change. In the aftermath of the 2004 election, John Kerry was clearly upset about it. And he thought, you know, anytime he talked climate change, he got painted as a Greenpeace, tree hugger, Sierra Club type guy. Nobody would listen to the facts. Of course, he's a politician. So he got with his buddies on the Hill, in particular Chuck Hagel, Warren Rudman, and Gary Hart, two Republicans now, two Democrats. And he said, isn't there a way we can talk about these subjects, and these subjects meaning climate change and nuclear security, energy security, American competitiveness, public diplomacy, from a factual perspective, but put a national security slant on each one of those? And who would be credible to talk about it from an apolitical perspective, who would lend the national security side to it? And they said, you know, perhaps the public would listen to 3- and 4-star generals, recently retired, who can detail why this is impacting your security on a daily basis. So they went about putting together a very small 501c3 nonprofit called the American Security Project. What they wanted was 2, 3, and 4 stars from each of the services, and they were successful in doing that and put them on our board. Some are still with us today, and we've got a 4-star Air Force General Lester Lyles, we've got 4-star Navy Admiral Fox Fallon, former Central Command. Tony Zinni was on our board. I mean, we've had them come and go, but we've always managed to keep at least 8 on this to kind of take the subject out of the political spectrum. And it's been, I think, relatively successful. So let me draw that point to why we're here today. About a year ago, some folks would listen to what we talked about on climate change and said, you know, you've got a pretty good message here, but you talk in the Beltway, but nobody outside the Beltway is hearing what you have to say. Can you not hit the road and talk to varied audiences? And by varied audiences, I mean all kinds. We've been to VFW halls, Chamber of Commerce. We were in a Presbyterian church last night, sewage treatment plants. And we have been to colleges, universities, 6-plus cities over the last 2 months now. We will continue that throughout the rest of this year and then probably, depending on funding, do it the following year to push this message out and let you all hear it from those who have it firsthand. And we feel, you know, confident that we're making some progress with this. Now, it's tough inside the Beltway. Everybody's familiar with what's going on there, and everybody say it's gridlock. I am not the eternal pessimist that many people would say about what's going on Capitol Hill today. I think there are great people up there, and we take our message up there all the time. I'm on the Hill probably weekly, I would guess. We are not a lobby organization, although I have a C4 that does some lobbying. But when I talk to the staffs in particular, and I know we have a staffer from Senator Reid's office here, they're smart, they're articulate, they understand the message. But that said, they're still politicians, and they still got to get the vote. We saw some of that yesterday, for instance, and I understand that. But when you dig down and keep pressing your message to them, I think ultimately they're going to get it, and you're going to make some progress here. And we've had some successes within the American Security Project, not the least of which was the New START Treaty, which we worked very hard on back in 2010 and 11. And then we worked on fusion funding, and at our table we were talking about fusion here earlier, which the administration had dropped out of the budget, and the Senate had surprisingly killed it, got put back in for the budget for 2014, and we're working on 2015 on that. So we believe strongly in our research and development funding for our energy sources. But that's not why we're here tonight. Here tonight to talk about climate change and its impact on national security. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce Andrew Holland, who's our fellow for energy and climate. And Andrew, by the way, is unabashed. He will say he's a Republican. He came from now Secretary, then Senator Hagel's staff. He handles climate and energy for us. And he's going to talk the science for a couple minutes. Then he'll turn it back to me. I'm going to walk around the world a little bit, giving you some very clear examples of what climate change is doing to our national security apparatus. And then I'm going to turn it over to Lieutenant General Seip, who will go farther around the world, talk about the Middle East and Africa, and then he'll turn it back to me, and I'll talk about the impact you have on it here. So with that, let me introduce Andrew Holland.
Steve, thank you. And I can kind of walk around here and do this. So I've got a couple of slides here. So I think we're going to jump forward a couple of here. We've already done that, done this. Okay, go back one more. Okay, so the science of climate change. Now, even if you know the climate is changing, even if you understand this, I think it's important to kind of walk through this to say, hey, look, there's a scientific background to this. This is happening, and this is happening now. But what we have to start with is the science. And so we have a board member, we have a member of our Consensus for American Security, Admiral Dave Tidley, who is the oceanographer of the Navy. And he got me into thinking about this. Climate change and the basic science of greenhouse gas emissions is what we can call it's cutting edge 19th century science. So the guys we see up here are Joseph Fourier, John Tyndall, and Svante Arrhenius. And the work they did was basically to find out why does the Earth keep heat and Mars doesn't and Venus keeps much more. And it's basically to work through how do greenhouse gases work, and you know basic understanding of this. And by the time Svante Arrhenius got the Nobel Prize in 1903, he was able to pretty clearly state that how much a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, how much the temperature increase that would do. But of course, he said, that's crazy. We'll never see a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It was a purely theoretical idea. Now, as Stacy said, we're at 400 ppm, which is getting darn near to the point where it's doubling. We're on a path to by 2035 or so. So it's accelerating and it's happening much faster than they thought. So on to the next, and I'm going to show that graphically here. You know, I can talk and all this, but I think it's important to be able to see this. First, you start with the facts. The facts are these. Temperature has increased about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900. And this is global mean temperature. And as you can see, it's not a straight linear change. Things happen, you know, weather happens. But climate is the long-term trend. And as you can see, since 1880, since 1900 especially, long-term upward trend. Next slide. And this breaks down even clearer when we look here at decade to decade. The decade of 2000 to 2010 was by far the warmest on record. Decade before that was the warmest on record. Decade before that was the warmest on record. And so on back until 1970. So we can see that this is a trend that is, you know, when you break out some of the year-to-year changes, you can see the decadal progressing upward. Next slide. The thing that people always tell me then is, but the climate has always changed. You know, climate has always changed. You know, what's different now? Well, yes, the climate has always changed, and that's absolutely true. So here's 400,000 years, and as you can see, we've done a pretty good job figuring out what the climate looked like over the last 400,000 years. And so you can see global temperature up, down, up, down. Here's an ice age. And it's actually been a bit warmer than it was about 100,000 years ago or so. And you can see CO2 concentration has gone up and down. Sea level, importantly, has gone up and down. Now, I note on the CO2 concentration up and down, but you see that big spike at the end. We're going to get to that. Next slide. So, what we've had is those 400,000 years, a lot of spikes upward and downwards, a lot of ice ages, interglacial periods, all of this sort of stuff. But we've had a remarkable run here for the last 8,000 years or so, going back to about 6,000, 7,000 BC. the world has seen a remarkable level of stability in the climate. And I think there's a good case to be made that what's happened in those 8,000 years? Well, you know, humans settled, started farming, developed cities, empires, the arts, literature. Most importantly, we've gone from 5 million people to about 7 billion people in the world. So big changes, and I think a big part of those changes was that we didn't have to use our big brains to think about how to adapt to a constantly changing climate, how to keep moving to deal with the changing glaciers and the changing sea levels and all of this sort of stuff. Because the climate was stable, we were able to adapt and adapt to those other things. So, next slide. But as you can see, we're no longer stable. This is the last 2,000 years, and as you can see, the last 200 years, you've beginning this upward trend and a big spike at the very end there. Next slide. So the interesting thing is that, what if this is natural? So with natural forces only, what we should be expecting is a gentle slide kind of back in towards that next ice age. You know, all these old, Newsweek had an article in 1975 saying we were global cooling going into an ice age. It's probably true. We probably were going towards an ice age. We had another 20,000, 30,000 years or so we could deal with that. But that's been all overtaken by human forcing. Next slide. So why is temperature increasing? It is increasing greenhouse gas concentration. So here's a basic slide on this. This is from the IPCC that Stacy was talking about. Next slide. Again, you can see here, this is tracking the temperature, both temperatures along with increasing CO2 concentration. That's important. The correlation is pretty clear and pretty stark. Next slide. And what's important is that the carbon from, we know that this increase in concentration of carbon is coming from fossil fuels and not from natural cycles, not from volcanoes, not from some other, the seas or something like that, because there's a unique fossil signature on fossil fuels. It's a slightly heavier atom. It's carbon. There's a little bit more carbon 13 in that, and we see that fingerprint more in the atmosphere as it goes up. So there is that fingerprint. Next slide. So what's the result? Global warming. And I like this slide because you can say, hey, look, climate's stable. Oh, look, how long has the climate been stable? It's stable. You know, we're cooling. Well, if you look at the long-term trends, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. So, next slide, and I think that's it for me. Oh, just one quick thing. I put up all those slides about warming, and that's all atmospheric warming. The kind of scary part of this is that most of the warming is going to the oceans, and we don't know when that's all going to come out, how that's all going to come out, how that's going to manifest itself. So, you know, I said this is basic 19th century science. There is still a lot of stuff we don't know, and the models aren't perfect, and that shouldn't actually give us hope as kind of give us fear, because we don't know how it's all going to work, and there is a lot of uncertainty in all this. So, next slide. And the models, again, the models, they're not perfect, but they've done pretty well. This is Jim Hansen's model from 1980. Long enough ago, they should start tracking back and looking at how predictions have come out. And as you can see, he was actually conservative. He was well under. As Stacy said, a lot of the models are conservative to what has been seen and what we should expect. Next slide. So I'm going to turn it back over to General Chaney. Thank you all for listening, and we can talk science if you want or anything like that, but I think these guys are better discussing than I am.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I didn't mean to beat you about the head and shoulders about the science business, but you watch what's on the TV or what you see in the papers. I could name specific networks. I think you know what they are. who look at the science and just deny it, and it's how do you refute what Andrew just put up there? But regardless of that, your military is your ultimate insurance policy. When everything goes to hell in a handbasket, you have a major disaster or an attack, you expect the Department of Defense to rise to that occasion and defend us. So I can tell you today, there are folks in the Pentagon and in each combatant command that are planning for the worst case scenario, and it includes climate change. Now, Stacy, you mentioned Emma Locklear, and indeed, Emma Locklear looks far out and he says, ultimately, what is causing instability in the Pacific Command, and it's climate change. And I'll give you a couple of very poignant examples, not the least of which was Typhoon Haiyan last year. Haiyan had sustained winds of 195 miles per hour, the worst windstorm typhoon they've ever had in the Pacific, and there were five super typhoons last year in the Pacific. Here's the kicker. Who responded to Haiyan? We did. The United States military, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, 13,000 of them went down and responded to that humanitarian assistance project in the Philippines. Why did we do that? Well, we're humanitarians, we respect life, we wanted to help them out, but really, we're the only ones who could do that. There's no other country in the world that has the capability to go over that expanse of ocean and bring that logistics to the Philippines and help them. So, you would think that perhaps in the Pacific Command, they're planning on more of these events to happening, and they are. Kind of an ancillary benefit of that, by the way, and we didn't do it because of this, but we have recently signed a new defense pact with the Philippines. So it wasn't lost on them that we came down and helped them out. Let me walk a little farther out into the Pacific Ocean in an island called Diego Garcia, where there's an entire Marine Expeditionary Brigade's worth of equipment on Diego Garcia. It's an island owned by the Brits. We lease it from them. In about 30 years, given the current climate, it's going to go underwater. We're going to have to move that brigade's worth of equipment somewhere. So let me move a little farther west. Bangladesh. Bangladesh is the poster child for climate change. A 1.5-foot rise in sea level will cause 5.5 million refugees in Bangladesh. Now here's the kicker on this one. Where are they going to go? Bangladesh has an armed border with India, and it's armed like East and West Berlin. India will not accept them. Myanmar won't either, nor will China. What's equally interesting about this one is I belong to a group called the Global Military Advisory Group on Climate Change, which is flag officers from all around the world who address this issue. And the chairman, current chairman, is a major general named Muni Razaman from Bangladesh. And he clearly understands this problem. Now, if you're familiar with Bangladesh, they got a lot of problems there politically. And they're a little more focused on that than they are what's going to happen in climate change. But I can tell you in about 20 years, they're going to have a major migration problem. Now, a number of our bases and stations are threatened here in the continental United States. All our naval bases are in trouble. One of my favorite stories I tell, I took over as commanding general of Parris Island in 1999. And my predecessor came to me, and I was really excited about running all these drill instructors and handling recruiting for the Marine Corps. He goes, none of those are going to be your problem. Your major problem is going to be hurricanes. And I really thought he was joking. But he had a good plan in there. 3 months later, Hurricane Floyd took dead aim at Parris Island, a Category 5 hurricane with a 25-foot surge, sea surge. Parris Island's 12 foot above mean sea level, so do the math. We were going to be underwater by about 15 feet. I had to move 8,000 recruits 200 miles in about 3 days before we would be hit by Floyd, and we moved them, and we did. Fortunately, Floyd just brushed us, but it went up to North Carolina, by the way, and cut Route 95 in half for 2 weeks. Not to say that I'm tainted, but I went down and took over a school in South Texas called the Marine Military Academy, and my first year there, what happened? We had a hurricane. Category 1 hurricane sat on our campus for 2 days. 18 inches of rain caused $5 million worth of damage. We just got back from Texas this morning. We were in Dallas last week. Texas has a huge drought problem. They have a huge water problem. They somewhat recognize this. They haven't figured out what the solution is. But my point is the military guys are responding to all these, not just nationwide, but worldwide, and it's a national security problem that the United States military is planning for. And as Stacy mentioned, it's in the QDR, Quadrennial Defense Review, which came out in February. There's 4 pages in there that the defense establishment is planning on what they're going to do about climate change, so they recognize that as a threat. With that, let me introduce Lieutenant General Norm Seitz. This is an aviator extraordinaire, because not only is he an Air Force aviator, but I would say you're a naval aviator, because he has done many takeoffs and landings on a joint tour with the United States Navy on aircraft carriers, if I'm correct.
Yes, sir.
Right? Norm Seitz.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, gang, thanks for being here tonight. Really appreciate it, and we appreciate the great hospitality. What I'm going to do, just to keep us on track, because we're more interested in hearing your questions than you are hearing from me, because I have a face for radio and not necessarily for public. So I'm going to get on with this, and I want to basically take you to three areas of the world and talk about climate change and the impact on our national security. And the first one is a place where is near and dear to everyone, is Iraq and Afghanistan. We've been there for the last 12 years. And we have spent a lot of treasure, and we have spilled a lot of blood, and we've lost a lot of sons and daughters there. And what was one of our biggest, I would call it our Achilles heel? It was our supply lines. It was the fact that 70% of those thousands and thousands of supply lines that we moved back and forth, those convoys, were moving water and fuel, just water and fuel alone. And they were a prime target to our enemies out there. From a from a time of 2004 to 2007, we lost 2,300 folks, both military and civilian contractors, either killed or injured on those convoys there. I was there for a year as the number two guy running all the air forces that were in that region there, and I can't tell you how many times we had to actually put airplanes over those convoys or divert airplanes from other important missions in order to protect our soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen that were moving those convoys back and forth, trying to bring fuel and water to our troops out there. So again, we need to be thinking about that, and we need to plan that into our future operations here. Because if we assume that that we're going to operate in the same climate as we do today, as we did, you know, for these past 12 years, I think we're going to end up repeating our mistakes, and that's not going to be good for any of us there. Let me take you to, again, I want to be able to get to the questions here. Let me take you to Syria. Now some of you go, what's climate change got to do with what's going on in Syria? Well, let me take you back to 2006 to 2010. Syria experienced its worst drought in recent history. And what did that mean? Well, it meant that over 1.5 million Syrians that were living on the land, trying to farm, were driven off the farms, and they were driven into areas like Aleppo, Homs, Daraa. Are those names familiar to you? That's where the fighting's taking place, because the government didn't have the infrastructure in place. So when we see those people moving, we don't call that the cause of the Syrian conflict or the Syrian civil war, but it certainly is a threat multiplier. It's an accelerant. It kind of takes that tinderbox and puts that flame to it there and causes those problems there. I'll take you to sub-Saharan Africa. I'll take you to Mali. Now again, the folks in northern Mali, very happy doing their farming in the north there, but again, a very severe drought took their arable land, took it away from them, basically put pressure on them. The government couldn't respond. They didn't have the infrastructure in place. Throw in a couple of things like what was going on in Libya and the Islamic extremists that moved down into Mali, bringing lots of weapons with them there. And again, you had the circumstances set up for that perfect storm, which turned out to be quite an effort there by the French, who again, they did the heavy lifting, but your United States military was there with air refueling, with airlift aircraft to move French troops back and forth, with airborne intelligence platforms, and with a lot of basic supply there. So I guess what I'm telling you here with this climate change, that it may not be directly impacting us right here in the great state of Nevada or in the southern United States or wherever there, but it makes your military get up and go and do its business, because the world counts on the United States. And whether we believe we're going to become more isolationist or not, the fact of the matter is, for the current, you know, way we're going, is that when bad things happen in the world, you know, who are you going to call? It's not the Ghostbusters, it's the United States military, and we're going to show up for it. So what does the military do about it? Well, I would tell you, we plan. And I think we plan pretty well. Although one of my 4 stars once told me, Norm, why plan when you can react? I think I'd submit to you, with climate change, the last thing you want to do is try to be reacting out there. So we've done, I think, a pretty good job in the military of planning, because bottom line is, whether you and I believe that humans are responsible or have some play in this climate change, the fact of the matter is, we can't afford to wait till we're 100% sure either way.
If we do, we found on the battlefield, when you wait for 100% assurance, you're in trouble. You're probably going to lose that battle and lose that war waiting for that 100% certainty. So the military is planning for the worst case, and we make assumptions. And based on those assumptions, we lay out plans. And then we look to see if those assumptions are going to play out. And if they don't, then we have follow-on plans there. And I would submit to you, those are the type of things that we as a country ought to be doing. We ought to be thinking about both our civilian leaders out there, our political leadership, and then we as an American public there, thinking about climate change and planning for it. If it doesn't come to fruition, great. Our sons and daughters or our kids that are yet to be born, you know, will be a generation that won't have to, you know, put up with some of the trends that Andrew showed there on the slides there. But if they do, then maybe we've done something to mitigate that. So before I get off the stage, let me just talk about a couple of things that in the military we try to do there. And we try to look at it into a more of a tiered type of approach there. And the tiered approach is first, adapt to the moderate warming that we are confronted with today. And that's the planning that we're doing out there in our militaries and a lot of our communities are doing, a lot of our regions are doing there. Second, reduce emissions to reduce the risk of the worst effects. Now, we don't take a stand on any one cause there. If you want to bring the EPA in, what they're going to do with our coal power plants there, I got that. We want to talk about the better fuel mileages that we're going to ask for our cars there. That's a way to do that. There's a whole lot of all of the above type of choices that we have out there. But we ought to look at how do we reduce emissions so that we can reduce the worst effects that Andrew talked about. And then last but not least is prepare. And specifically, we prepare those contingency plans, and we monitor the data, we monitor the information available to us so that we can identify those disastrous tipping points and see them beforehand so that possibly we can minimize those tipping points and allow us to take the proper action there. So the question I posed to you before I turn it back over to Steve to talk about some of the things closer to home with regard to climate change and national security is, should the question be, how can we afford to do this? Or should the question be, how can we afford not to do this? And I would submit to you that question is the latter of the two. How can we afford not to do something about what is very apparent to us? It's no longer a scientific debate. When you look at the last couple of years, the articles that have been put out, I think out of the 2,900 articles written, only two were opposing to climate change and human involvement. So it's really a political debate that's going on out there. And a political debate has nothing to do with reality. I'm sorry. It has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing to do, I mean, I get it, all politics are local, and we've got to take our stands and stuff, but when you strip that all away, it's a political debate. And a political debate is not going to solve this problem. So again, I pose that question to you. You in the room here are going to be the ones to answer that. And the idea being that if we want to make America safe and secure tomorrow, we ought to take actions today. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Steve and talk about some things a little bit closer at home. And I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
General, thanks. Stacy took some of my thunder when you talked about Norfolk. I'm going to bring this home to the continental United States, then I'm going to bring it to Las Vegas. But Norfolk's going underwater. I mean, it's just a fact of the matter, and they understand it and they know it. If you read that article in the Washington Post, there's a Baptist church there that now schedules its church services around the tidal chart because the tide's coming up over the flood wall because of sea rise. The naval station is indeed going underwater, as is the Naval Air Station. Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, it was closed, that along with Pensacola, about 3 weeks ago because of major flooding. They will both go underwater. But let me pull this home a little bit, and I think perhaps, Pat, maybe you ought to give this part, but you've got water shortages here, and I don't think you're any stranger to it, and I put my glasses on because I'm going to read some of this to you. You've had a severe drought here. It's the lowest flow of the Colorado River in 1,200 years. It fits predictions for the Southwest about climate change. It's real, and it's happening now. Lake Mead on the Colorado River is the source of 90% of your water. Right now, it's at the lowest level since the Hoover Dam was built. It's at 1,087 feet. If it reaches 1,075 feet, the federal government will start automatic water cuts in Arizona and Nevada. And this could happen as soon as next year. Of course, I hear we flew up here today. This is the hottest I've been in about 2 years, 105 degrees when we got in the car today. Yep, it's going to get hotter, folks. The average temperature here has increased 4 degrees in just the last 4 decades, and that's as measured at McCarran Airport. Your summer high temperature will continue to grow worse. It's going to be a combination of urban heat and climate change. So you are very vulnerable here to climate change. Now, this isn't necessarily something the Department of Defense is going to fix here, but folks, we got to do something about it. So I know that's kind of a sad note to end on, but again, I'm here to pitch the national security side. So I appreciate your attentiveness. I really hope you have some good questions for us, and let's open it up. Thank you very much.
Right, I'll moderate the questions for them, but won't answer them. But as a moderator, I get to ask the first question, and it's for General C. Since you were the commander of the task force for the Horn of Africa, did you save Captain Phillips?
No, but I think the movie writes anytime.
Very good. All right. We only have one microphone, so if you can speak loudly, we'll see if we can repeat the question and then take it from there. Pat, please.
Well, you've talked about the rest of the world and the social unrest that's going on now. You look in California right now, there are rural communities within the Central Valley because of the California drought, where you've got 60 to 70% unemployment this year. Food banks can't produce enough food to feed the populace of these communities. There has to be a contingency plan for the military to help calm those, what will be troubled waters here in the United States.
Well, I can take it. I think you're talking civil unrest here in the United States.
Yeah.
And to call the Department of Defense, first you go on your local civil authorities, then you go to the Guard, National Guard, and then the last resort is the United States military. So specifically, I don't know of any real plans that the United States has to feed the people in the valleys of California other than breaking out the MREs, but it's a problem. It's a huge problem. And I hope they're not ignoring it over in California. It's just something they've got to understand. Norman, yes ma'am.
Okay, in our country, we have the resources. It's gonna be a mess, but we have the resources to move things offshore and inland. Things might get really bad, but we're going to be able to muddle through. What are we going to do in countries like Bangladesh, and when you look at Indonesia, you look at the social unrest, and those people and the people in Africa who are suffering, when they all start coming, what are we going to do then? Because we're under attack now. Our schools can't handle it. Our tax base can't handle it. A generation of kids are coming up that can't read and write. We don't have the money and the resources for that. We're not going to be able to muddle through if all of these people try to get to our shores, because we are the country that has the resources to move things.
Yeah, I mean, they'd all love to come here and live our lifestyle, that's for sure. I think our point here is that we are the ones who are contributing to climate change. We need to do something about it. Ultimately, that's CO2 reduction. And however you do it, the president announced his percentage reductions here this last week, which is one way to go about it. Of course, the hard right went crazy about it. There are some on the right say a carbon tax and cap and trade. There are multiple ways to go about doing this. My point to the politicians is, use our argument on the national security side to talk to your constituents and say, we got a problem here. A lot on the right don't like the word tax, okay? We'll change it to something else. You use it a trade or a cap and trade or have an incentive that will help reduce the CO2 pollution in the air. It's got to be done. We are the number two polluter in the world. Number one is China. And China, we haven't even talked about China today, but China's got some immense problems. They recognize it, but they can't fix it. They're bringing a coal-fired power plant online every 2 weeks. But they're also investing in nuclear. They're also investing in fusion. They're going crazy for other sources. They just signed a big gas deal with Russia, as you're probably familiar. Much better to have them burning gas instead of coal, by the way. Same with us. There are ways, but if we don't start getting on board and fixing the CO2 problem, it's just going to get worse. and we're going to multiply that, and then you're going to rely on the Department of Defense to defend our country from huge immigration problems and instability worldwide. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I have a question. How do you approach politicians in Washington that are opposing climate change?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think if I got your question right, how do we approach politicians who are in opposition?
Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of the premise upon which the American Security Project was started, because they were so upset that you had the hard deniers on the right. But let me give you a really poignant example, and it's a ex-congressman named Bob Inglis from South Carolina, who I know well. He was a two-term Republican, hard right Tea Party conservative in South Carolina. In his primary debate, running for his third shot at it, he said, you know, he's a smart guy. He said, there is something to climate change. So his opponent in the Columbia newspaper ran a front page ad about Inglis, you know, believing in climate change, and he got killed in the primary in South Carolina. Well, that wasn't lost on Lindsey Graham or Joe Wilson or anybody else from South Carolina. They know down there if they even breathe the word, they're probably in trouble. Now, I understand that. Get them through the primary, it's a hugely Republican state, they'll get elected. But once they've been elected, these are smart guys. And I think there's a window of opportunity there to get at them after the election, and when there's maybe, in a lame duck session or later on, to work them where they're able to use the cover that we give them with the national security argument. If they need be, I can give them a dozen generals and admirals and sit there and talk about it, and they can trot them out and stand beside them and talk climate change if they would so ask me. I haven't had Lindsey Graham ask me or anybody else in South Carolina for a matter, but that's the hard right, that's the worst case scenario. But there are some in there that are more centrist that are listening to our argument. And again, that's why we're pitching it this way. If it's Greenpeace or the Sierra Club or the hard left, forget it. I mean, they're not even gonna step into it. But if you can bring admirals and generals into it, you're probably gonna listen. Let me shift over. Yes, sir.
Is Norfolk in more or less trouble than Venice and Amsterdam?
So Norfolk, I would think it's in more trouble than, certainly more trouble than Amsterdam, and Venice, they're already mitigating the trouble. So they've already built the flood walls, they've already done all of this sort of stuff. So Venice is sinking, but they've made the investment because they knew it was sinking. The problem with Norfolk is the double-sided whammy that it's sinking. The whole East Coast there is sinking. The whole bottom of the Chesapeake Bay is sinking. And you can't build a flood wall big enough across the entry to the Chesapeake Bay. So you're kind of stuck doing coastal remediation and this sort of stuff. So you combine that with the sea level rise, and there's tidal gauges there that's showing 12 inches of sea level rise over the last century. That's a foot of sea level rise. The global mean sea level rise was about an inch, two inches over the last century or so. It's accelerating now, but you have this weird thing where the East Coast of the United States is sinking, and also the seas are rising faster there. So it's a kind of a funny perfect storm.
Can I have a follow up? Is climate change more or less important than our deficit in terms of our security?
Well, sir, I'll leave this to either of you guys, but.
We get this question all the time. Like Locklear saying climate change is ultimately the biggest threat that he's gotten. And somebody going, well, what about terrorism? We got terrorism. Isn't that that's a threat today? Yeah, it is a threat today. But when he looks 10, 20, 30, 50 years out, he says climate change is going to contribute to much more instability in his area of operations than terrorism will. Nonetheless, terrorism is still a problem. Now, you asked about the deficit, right? And, when you look over what's gone on in the last 2 years with sequestration on lead business, it's very troubling to the Department of Defense. But we were at Army Installation Command, Fort Sam Houston yesterday. We were at Nellis today. We've been visiting a lot of bases, looking at what they're doing for alternative energies and what they're doing to save money and what they're doing to help stop pollution and get themselves off of fossil fuels. The DOD gets that. But if you're going to continue to use sequestration or cut back on the DOD budget, they're going to have to cut back somewhere. But they all the services get it more than I think any other department, certainly in the United States government. Is the deficit much more of a threat than climate change? I don't think so. You know, I think we've got to solve our budget problems. But here's where I say there's a little light at the end of the tunnel. Whoever thought we'd get a signed budget last a year ago, and then in December they proposed the budget, in January it got signed. I mean, we haven't had one for 4 years. So, you know what I mean? There's a little light at the end of this tunnel. I think there's some room for this. The real problem is not the military spending, by the way. It's entitlements, but I'm not going to get into that tonight. Yes, ma'am.
I was fortunate enough to land a good job working with one of the government departments. But as a young voter, are there any plans to help work with the DOE or the DOD to create career jobs for young people with initiatives like this?
I wish.
Andrew said he wishes. Yeah, I know. I don't know to answer your question. We do work with the Department of Energy, the American Security Project does, particularly on the fusion side and some of the science side, and they've got their own budgeting problems. I think it's a fabulous idea. I recommend you write a letter to Secretary Moniz.
Or a certain senator.
Or a certain senator, sure. And say, hey, this is a great idea. You know, let's go for it. Yes, sir.
Yes, my question is for General C. He said, for security tomorrow, take action today. If we go back to when the United States or your organization realized that this drought had occurred in Syria, is the outcome today what you planned out?
No, because we didn't really look at the climate aspects of it until after the fact. You know, it's when we did that kind of walk back history and said, holy smokes, you know, as we put more of a magnifying glass, more of a spotlight, more of a laser on this whole idea about climate change and the impact that it has, not just on, you know, someone trying to make a living on the farm, but what it may have on a fragile nation state out there. So a lot of that's hindsight. So what we're trying to do now is look at climate change across the area and figure out, along with our partner nations out there, what impacts may be coming down the road, and try to return those so that we don't have those 6 years of that drought and don't think about the infrastructure that needs to be in place. In fact, if we can't support those farmers on that land that are going to move to the cities there. Is it easy to do? Absolutely not. Is it the bright, shiny object out there? Not all the time. Sometimes it takes that crisis for everyone to have that mediating moment and go, man, if we had just looked 5 years earlier and then focused on this, maybe we could have prevented that.
But the United States has done everything it can to destabilize that regime. And so is that part of this? Is that part of a plan?
No, I wouldn't say that someone drew up a plan that started back there with the 2010 or 2006 drought and worked their way through that. I mean, someone could probably make that case if they wanted to. I personally don't know.
No, I don't think so.
Just ma'am.
My name is Maria. I think that part of what was mentioned is we have to create jobs for the future. And the second thing, has there been a prediction for what would happen as the sea levels rise and contamination of fresh water? Because that would be a really big, huge concern.
Yeah, when it comes to the jobs, you're absolutely right. I mean, who built the best batteries? We did. Where are the best batteries built now? China. Who built the first wind turbines? The United States of America did. Where are the best turbines built now? Brazil and Germany. That's the future. If you're waiting for the steel industry to come back with all the jobs that were lost, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, you're going to be waiting for a long time. We need to move forward and think about the future and those type of jobs so that we don't end up a nation being service-oriented that has that mix of service as well as technology that allows us to lead turn the events out there and be the economic driver of the world. That's my own personal opinion.
going back to the DOE there, you know, all the guys like my age and gals my age, we're all getting ready to retire. There's going to be this big gap in the federal employment if, in fact, we don't do something to attract folks like yourselves into that business there. And we certainly need to make it attractive from the standpoint of respect for the professionals that are in, you know, our departments of energy and defense and agriculture and other places like that.
Pat.
One last question. Maybe it's more stated. I mean, I couldn't agree with everything you said. And I agree that the time to make those changes is now. However, the reality is tomorrow we were at CO2 emissions at the ideal level. We won't turn the climate around that. We will live the consequences. My plea to you is that as you go around the country, you encourage communities to start putting this into their risk assessment calculus and be willing to take those blinders off and look at least over the next, let's say that we do meet the carbon emission standards. But even with that, how do you adapt? How do you guide your community through a process of adaptation to where they're ready for it? That is as critical to me as it is getting rid of the CO2 emissions, because our children are going to live the consequences of that which cannot be undone. And those leaders have got to start thinking differently. So my plea to you is please put that risk assessment, and it's a simple business risk assessment. Look at your public services in the same way. Where are the threats? Where are the liabilities? What do you have to do in order to react?
No, I think you're right. Could not have said that better. The old battleship analogy applies. You turn the rudder, and then, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes later, the ship starts to turn. Well, we haven't even started to turn the rudder, and we've already poisoned the environment, and it's going to take decades, maybe even a century, to fix what we've already done. So you've got the defeatists who go, we can't fix this. Well, we started it, we can stop it. It's not going to be fixed, I hate to say it, in your and my lifetime. But our grandkids are going to have a real problem. And it's interesting when we talk to folks, it's just kind of like during the 60s and 70s, the younger generation kind of gets it. You know, if we can mobilize them to get on the folks on Capitol Hill and say, hey, here's the deal. And then you're right. Interestingly also, local governments and mayors respond in our situations from us better than national level politicians. Take no offense. They understand it, they get it, and they say, hey, we got to start doing something about it. So that's it's a grassroots problem. But I got your message. So
Pat,
I appreciate
your key words that I'm going to put words in your mouth are resiliency and sustainment. You see more universities talking about sustainment and working with their communities and this idea about resiliency. Okay, we got a problem now. It's going to be here for a while. How do we deal with it, have that flexibility, that resiliency, in order to deal with it long term when we take care of the things short term?
I think we're going to wrap it up now. We've got a timeline on us. And
before we close, we have a representative from Senator Reid's office with us this evening, Vin Espadelson. I think he'd like to offer a thank you to our speaker.
Yeah. Thank you so much. On behalf of Senator Reid, I just wanted to present a certificate of commendation for the American Security Project for being here today and spreading awareness of these important national security and climate change issues. As you know, Senator Reid's a champion of all these issues and solutions that our friends here are advocating.
Okay. All right, we'll do a picture shot here.
Well, and I'll just close up right real quick before the picture. And so we convene a National Clean Energy Summit. This year it'll be September 4th. Pat Mulroy has spoken at it before. Secretary of the Navy has spoken at it before. So invite all of you to attend. Thank you.
And I've attended it before, and I think it's a very, very worthwhile investment of your time for the day.
You're the man.
All right, in wrapping up, we want to thank our two generals and Andrew Holland for an insightful and I think a provocative presentation this evening. And I'd like to ask Stan Perry, our president, to come up and give a token of our appreciation. And since Andrew was a walk-on, unfortunately, I know they'll have to share the largesse with your colleagues.
We're very honored to have you here tonight, and I think we've all gone away with a little bit of more inspiration about our individual responsibilities. And we have here a token of our appreciation to remind you of our appreciation for being here.
It's a beautiful globe. Thank you very much.
With pleasure. So we thank you very much once again for being here, and I'll turn the mic back to Stacy.
Get the package put away here for us. Well, I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. It was terrific to see so many new faces in the crowd, and I hope that you'll take the opportunity to consider joining the World Affairs Council. The only way we can support programs that you've experienced this evening is through increasing our membership. So we're on the website. You've got brochures out at front where you came in that you can pick up a program and keep up view us on the website. You'll see what our next programs upcoming are. We kind of take a bit of a hiatus in the summer just due to the temperature, but we'll be going full steam by early September, and I hope many of you will join us as new members. And thank you once again for joining us, and thank you, Spanish Trail, for hosting us this evening. Thank you.